Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to cleanorigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for 10% off your purchase. That's cleanorigin.com, code RADIO10.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer? Whenever I want?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. 94% of Sleep Number smart sleepers report better sleep. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. To find a store near you, visit sleepnumber.com.
With a raging El Nino in effect, the Eastern Pacific hurricane season was bound to be above average. However, the number of storms that have impacted land has been surprising. From October 9th to October 25th, Western Mexico has been hit by 4 consecutive tropical cyclones. 3 were hurricanes at landfall, and the one we're going to focus on today is Hurricane Otis. First thought to make landfall as either a strong tropical storm or a weak hurricane, it ended up becoming the strongest landfalling hurricane in the Eastern Pacific in under 24 hours. How did this happen? And what can we as an industry learn about the storm to help improve forecasting and communications in the future? That is today's Weather Geeks podcast. I'm meteorologist Jen Carfagno here with Dr. Greg Postel, and we want to dive right into this. Greg, you know, this is something that truly hit all of us pretty hard when we saw how fast Otis started its rapid intensification.
Yeah, I remember, you know, starting to get the signals from various social media outlets that I follow from the Hurricane Center, for example, that things were starting to evolve very differently than what we even expected, let's say, in the early morning hours. So by midday, 6 to 12 hours prior to landfall, we started to see the signs that this was taking a turn in an unexpected way, which is one of the key things about this. This took all of us by surprise. You're right about that.
I mean, we all looked at it, and certainly no one closer than the National Hurricane Center was watching it very closely. But we looked at it personally on our show in the morning, and we thought, yeah, maybe a, you know, strong tropical storm, possible hurricane, and really didn't see much more than that. So
and
today,
maybe not even directly impact Acapulco.
No,
because the track changed too.
The track changed too.
Yep.
And so we want to delve into that in today's podcast. This is something that has a lot of meteorologists talking, certainly after the fact. Our hearts are with the people of Mexico and Acapulco, and we're seeing images come out of there that are just absolutely devastating. I mean, this is a Cat 5.
And it is a huge international story that we're going to be following for a long time yet to come, because we know that so many people have been cut off from, you know, resources that they need to survive. And it's going to be one of those things that, unfortunately, it's not going to take weeks or months to recover from. It, you know, could take a lifetime.
I think the discovery is going to continue to take weeks, though, to really know exactly what happened. So let's go backwards and just delve into this hurricane season in particular in the Eastern Pacific. I remember us talking about how slow of a start it got. It was the end of June before we even saw our first name system out here.
And it's been so active in the East Pacific. Yeah. I mean, it really has been. I mean, we've had 8 major hurricanes this season, and that is one shy of the record. We're not done yet, maybe.
Yeah.
Hopefully we are, but we might not be.
We might not be. No.
And this has been one of those seasons for the record books in the East Pacific. And I think going into it, I think the bigger picture, given a lot of the larger scale things that we look at when we look at hurricane seasons in advance, were there. The table was kind of set in an El Nino kind of way for lots of tropical cyclone activity there. And it certainly took a little while to get there, but it's now off to the races.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. So we had just recently, though, I talked about the 4 storms. We had Lydia, Norma, Otis in short order here. Interesting about Otis is it formed in between the 2 landfalls of Norma, which we had been paying a lot of attention to. So Otis kind of snuck in there.
Right. I was distracted by Norma. And maybe, you know, it's one of those things where you don't expect one after the other in that kind of fashion. but we got it rapid fire. And boy, did we get it.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's really dive right into what happened that day. We were watching Otis. It didn't look terribly organized. And then all of a sudden it did. And so one thing that we keep pointing back to is the satellite presentation of it and how it quickly got that look. But it took a while from the satellite perspective for it to catch up with the intensity within. The Hurricane Hunters really found it first.
I remember seeing, that's right, the some of the data coming back from the Hurricane Hunters and their reconnaissance, all of a sudden, unexpectedly saying, whoa, we're on to something here. We are, you know, detecting something that's a lot more intense than we thought we were going to fly into. And that's a sign that, you know, when hurricanes become Cat 5s, it all happens really quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, they undergo this period where so much happens in such a short amount of time. This was one of those cases that happened, obviously, on a time scale faster than we've ever seen it practically. It's very high among the list of most rapidly intensifying systems. And it was one of those cases where everything had lined up literally and figuratively in a way to support such an explosive development.
But they were very subtle features that lined up. So it wasn't obvious. Obviously, it wasn't obvious to forecasters. It wasn't obvious to the models at all. The weather models didn't see any of this coming.
We have a graph to show about that.
You know, we've been looking at this. Yeah.
Which goes back to, let's say it made landfall, very early Wednesday morning local time. And going back a little more than 24 hours prior, let's say late Monday night. Mm-hmm. So this is really, I don't know if you can see this.
Yeah, for anyone watching on YouTube or on a streaming app, you can see what we're talking about is that what happened in green is far surpassing anything in the forecast.
So even, you know, a day in advance of day before landfall, the models, and we only showed you a few of them, but I can't think of any model that came anywhere close to capturing or verifying. They were all saying the same thing. You know, the hurricane models, global models, you name it, they were forecasting, as you said, tropical storm, maybe lower end hurricane, nothing of the sort that we ended up getting. So, you know, we ask ourselves, what did they miss? And it's from our vantage point right here, right now, it's too soon to tell. But I do know science will be asking these very questions and have already, and we'll be diving into it in depth with all the great minds on the problem. And, you know, we knew and we know what the condition of the oceanic environment was. We pretty much know what the atmospheric environment was like around Otis. That was no mystery. So then what else was it? What were we missing in the interior of the storm? Something in the inside, I think, was what let it go.
And that was unique to the storm. Every storm is unique. We say that all the time.
That's
Every single storm is unique. When we look at the conditions surrounding it, though, one thing that a lot of us keep pointing to now is that, well, it went over a batch of really warm water, and it not just warm on top, but really deep oceanic heat content.
The water temperatures, you're right, at the surface were well above average. This is a warm spot, even relative to what's typically expected this time of year. But the depth of that warm water was very significant. And it's called oceanic heat content. It's essentially a very good measure of the fuel that the tropical cyclone can access oceanically. So it was able to grab a hold of that, this localized pool of incredibly volatile ingredients from the ocean. This thing went right over it. And clearly the atmosphere said, you know what? You can use whatever you can from that ocean. I'm going to open up that window for you. And it did. So you have to look at it from a sort of a combined, coupled sense.
It's not one thing.
It's not one thing.
It can't be, because we've seen many storms go over deep ocean heat content.
Right.
And they don't all rapidly intensify.
And they don't all. That's exactly right. So this was the atmosphere and ocean conspired perfectly in order to allow it to happen. So it almost maximized what it could. You know, there's these theoretical numbers that can be derived from the ocean, the atmosphere, about how intense tropical cyclones can get. Mm-hmm. They're never, of course, reached, because there's a lot of assumptions that go into it. But it combines both the warmth and the depth of the warm water in the ocean and a measure of the stability in the atmosphere above. And when they work together, you can get outcomes like this. And that's exactly what we saw.
Yeah. Well, let's actually talk about that, because something else that, you know, what are people talking about in the aftermath of this in terms of the forensics of the meteorology? The jet stream. And there's been talk of, well, there was maybe this stronger area loft of some stronger jet stream winds that helped ventilate. But when you look at a map, and I'll pull that up for people who are watching and streaming, when you look at a map, it's not close. It's not close to the hurricane.
And that's an interesting point because, you know, for decades and even longer, people have been wondering the interaction of mid-latitude upper troughs and tropical cyclones. Is it good or is it bad? And, you know, in some ways, it's really bad. In other ways, there's actually some benefit that a tropical cyclone can extract from the nearby presence of an upper trough like this one. You can't get too close because if you get too close, wind shear, dry air, other you know, things that are harmful to the production of tropical development become really involved, and that's not good. But there is an optimal place for them to be. And it's not so much that it, you know, the nearby trough brings, you know, its ascent with it and moistens the atmosphere and does other things. I think more importantly than anything else, as you mentioned, it allows it to ventilate its high altitude outflow. Very far away. A hurricane needs to do that to survive and to grow and get stronger. It's got to deposit that outflow, the mass at high altitudes near the tropopause at great distances, or else it's going to fall back on itself. So imagine like the in, up, and out sort of, you breathe in. If you can't exhale, you're going to suffocate. Hurricanes need to exhale. And if they can do that really effectively, then they're going to be able to tap the ocean and the fuel underneath it and allow that fire to burgeon. Right? It's like a flame, right?
Yeah.
It blows up like that. And if you can get that, you know, ventilation going, you can feed that fire and allow it to grow even more very quickly.
The series of events lining up doesn't happen very often.
No.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the role of the size of Otis and just the fact that we're in El Nino right now. So quick break.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
We are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm meteorologist Jen Carfagno from the Weather Channel. Got Dr. Greg Postel here, a hurricane specialist from the Weather Channel. We're doing a deep dive on Hurricane Otis. You know, it's still pretty fresh. It was just 2 days ago that it ramped up to Cat 5 within, you know, less than 24 hours, a little bit more than 12 hours, and made landfall in Acapulco. And we're talking through what could have led to not just the rapid intensification, but the rapid intensification with very little warning, with no warning. I'll just say that. There was, you know, not a lot of signs of
Imagine being in Acapulco, living there, visiting there, and, you know, that morning thinking you might get some rain and some wind, but nothing particularly that you can't manage. Thinking that maybe there'd be a tropical storm making landfall somewhere, you know, maybe 50 miles away that morning. And then tuning out from any source of information coming your way.
Yeah, certainly as a tourist, you would. Why would you?
Why?
Yeah.
I mean, if I were there and I saw that, I would, that morning, I would think, okay, well, I know what's going to happen, I think. And I'll go on with the rest of my plans. And then it comes in. And then by that time, it's too late to enact your, you know, preparations.
Yeah. You know what?
That's
because
incredible.
Because forecasts are usually that good.
That right, we're suckered into feeling good about those forecasts 24 hours in advance, and this is a reminder that maybe some cases we're just not there yet.
Yeah, no, this is a tough one. You know, certainly most difficult for the people of Acapulco who are dealing with the aftermath of this, and you know, meteorologists are taking this one hard, I think, because there just wasn't the opportunity to provide communication on it very far in advance. We talked about
before you do that. Yeah. I just want to say I feel really bad for a lot of the forecasters whose, you know, careers are built on doing exactly this, warning people and preparing people. We did the best we could. The Hurricane Center did the best they could with all the available data at hand.
Right.
And we're on top of it as quickly as they could be. And it's really, you know, I feel really a lot for those forecasters who dedicate their lives to saving people in harm's way in this kind of case. And, you know, it just was just a worst case scenario that happened the worst possible way.
The nightmare situation that, you know, the Hurricane Center talked about in their discussion. And I think literally every other meteorologist out there has mentioned at some point in in this discussion after the fact.
They did the best job they could under this you know, worst case scenario.
It's worst case scenario. The storm that rapidly intensifies without any real signs of it coming and hits a populated area.
It hits. That's right. I mean, you couldn't think of a worse concoction of events. Yeah. Right. You have this scenario, which imagine, you know, what about in the Gulf of Mexico on the other side? Right. We could see something like this in Tampa. We could see something like this in Houston or New Orleans. Right. We haven't yet seen this kind of perfect storm, but there's no reason to think it couldn't happen or won't in the future.
So let's look, talk about the size of Otis and maybe could that be a factor in allowing this to happen? So we talked about the ocean heat content. We talked about perhaps some ventilation from jet stream far away, but perhaps a link to that. Let's talk about the, just the very fact that it was small.
Yeah. And this is an interesting point. And I'm probably not the best person to talk about this, but, you know, we were looking at the size of the storms and the scale of the storminess in the middle of it. The smaller it is, I feel like there, the more upside there is, or certainly the more potential there is for rapid intensification. The larger storms, which are spread out, have lots of things that can get in their way. You know, when a storm is bigger, it can start to attract non-tropical air and bring it into the interior, which would slow down its progress. You know, and when things are all happening in a very small area like this, if you constrain the heating, the latent heating with the convection in the middle of the storm, the thunderstorm activity, then you can lower the pressures much more effectively than if you would if the heat were spread out over a larger area. Your pressures will come down. You're more likely to have the convection to organize in a way that would clear out an eye and then drop the pressures rapidly from there. So I think you're onto something, that the scale of the initial disturbance matters a lot. And how that plays into intensification, it seems like that the smaller storms might have a better shot at you know, insulating themselves from
any
harmful
other
environment.
Right. Any other predator, so to speak, in terms of the environment.
Yeah.
Do you think the fact that we are in an El Nino is a factor here?
Well, with the SSTs warmer than average in the East Pacific during El Nino, I couldn't imagine it's not a role.
Yeah.
You know, exactly how much, I don't know. But I mean, this is one of those situations where going into the season, with water temperatures typically warmer than average in the East Pacific and some of the upper atmospheric, you know, favored dynamics, I guess. This is characteristic of an El Nino season where you can get a lot of these types of systems, and less so over the Atlantic, or at least ones that behave differently over the Atlantic.
These are the types of hurricanes that make us look at every other hurricane differently. I think after Michael, remember in the Gulf of Mexico back in, was it 2018? And that went through rapid intensification. And it surpassed well beyond what the models had said, although the models were still pointing towards intensification, maybe a major, right? But it went to Cat 5. And I think that made forecasters really take a harder look at the importance of when a hurricane tracks over really deep ocean heat content, if everything else is perfect, you're going to get rapid intensification.
You know, it reminds me of, and we talked about this a little bit off camera earlier yesterday, I think, or the day before, reminds me of Opal, Hurricane Opal back in the mid 90s, 1995. And I chased that storm. I drove all the way from Wisconsin to the Gulf Coast, and I almost turned around halfway, because at that time, Opal was, I think, coming out of the Caribbean, moving northward. It was going to cross the Gulf of Mexico, and it was struggling. And then in a matter of just a few hours, it went over one of those high heat content, the ocean eddies, those warm core eddies, and it exploded and went to high end Cat 4, I think. I don't even think it was 150 miles per hour, something like that, but very quickly, very rapidly. And then weakened, you know, when it finally made a close encounter with the coastline. But we've seen hurricanes do this before a lot, you know, when they go over these eddies and these pockets of very warm water and high heat content that they sometimes just absolutely explode.
Yeah. The question then, I think, is, well, why doesn't every storm that go over one of these hot pockets explode in intensity? Because they don't. There's many that don't.
You said it earlier. I mean, you need that cooperation with the atmosphere. And if you don't have it, you're not going to be able to maximize what the ocean is providing.
Yeah.
You know, if you have, you know, even a little wind shear, yes, sometimes that can be good, but sometimes sneaky pockets of dry air find their way into interiors more often than not, especially on the Atlantic side. We see that all the time. Dry air is coming in from this direction. It's coming in from this direction. It's going to, you know, all of a sudden interfere with the circulation. And that happens a lot. And
there's shear, there's dry air, there's,
the Atlantic generally is a very difficult place to support, a mature hurricane for very long.
Right. It's not like the Western Pacific.
It's not at all like the Western or even like Eastern Pacific.
But
in this
case, the Eastern Pacific is not usually like this.
The Atlantic is a rough place. If you're a burgeoning tropical cyclone and you want to become this long-lived event, good luck. I mean, yes, we've seen some of those last a long time, but not at a high intensity. They always tend to eventually run into problems, especially as they gain latitude and start moving northward.
So it's almost like most of the time we're going to have warm water somewhere in its path, along its path. I mean, there's enough pockets of this out there in the Western, like when you're talking about the Atlantic, you've got the Western Caribbean, you've got the Gulf of Mexico, there's spots. There are these pockets in the Eastern Pacific. So really need to look at all the other features to see what's lining up, because it's these subtle things. You mentioned the humid atmosphere over top of Otis. That's, again, very subtle.
Yeah. But
and
it was
small.
It was all there. And then you had, again, that sort of close proximity of that upper trough. And, you know, that I remember back when I was in graduate school 1,000 years ago, I had a colleague working on the role of these upper troughs, but as they penetrated into the ITCZ over the Pacific, how that influence allowed thunderstorm activity to flourish. You had, you know, one of these upper troughs coming nearby. And what it did was, is it changed what's called the inertial stability in the outflow layer. So in other words, these areas in the ITCZ were able to like vent their outflow. They were able to, the high altitude air atop these convective plumes or these convective regions were able to send the mass at a great distance. And I know this is kind of shop talk, but it's really important.
That's what the Weather Geeks podcast is for.
That's what it's for. It's really important to know how the hurricane or whatever the case would be, like when I was describing the plumes of thunderstorms in the ITC, it's very important that they're able to exhale. And when you reduce the inertial stability, you can exhale farther. It's a measure of resistance to lateral movement, essentially. And if you can, you know, throw stuff far away and exhale very far, then you can take a deep breath. And that's what creates your thunderstorms and all the latent heating in the interior of these engines.
This is smart stuff. We're going to take another quick break, Greg, and then we'll come back and talk about the future of forecasting this kind of event.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We are back now on the Weather Weather Geeks podcast, and here with Dr. Greg Postel, I'm meteorologist Jen Carfagno, talking about Hurricane Otis and the rapid intensification and the truly storm that became a Cat 5 with very little warning. We've stepped through, you know, after the fact now we can look at and see, well, what could have possibly led to this? But let's talk about the future of predicting rapid intensification. There's lots of studies. I feel like every week we're learning of a new study. There was a recent one a few weeks ago that showed in the Atlantic Basin that in the past 20 years compared to the 20 years prior to that, so compared to the 80s to the 2000s, there has been a basin-wide increase by 36% in storms that have rapidly intensified. So we're able to see it happening. It's all about forecasting when it's happening.
It's a new world, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's changing with the climate. The odds of RI now, maybe not everywhere.
Yeah.
But you were saying some of the oceanic basins.
More than others.
The trends are there.
So are our weather models suited for that?
Oh, boy.
This is a big question. I'm not expecting an answer, but we need to have a discussion about it.
I imagine that, you know, we're looking at that.
Yeah.
You know, we're trying to understand, you know, the delicate coupling between mm-hmm. the transfer of heat from the ocean to the mm-hmm. atmosphere and the timescale at which it happens and how that then relates to the development and the production of, you know, deep convection. It's, you know, that interface between the ocean and the atmosphere, you know, so much happens in such a small depth, mm-hmm. and yet it can have such incredible influence on what ultimately takes place, mm-hmm. you know? So little things like that. This is getting way out of here, on way out of my depth. But I imagine that the great modelers in the tropical world are, you know, constantly evolving in their understanding of the ways to parameterize this transfer of heat and other things to better accurately simulate what really happens. Because again, models are just, you know, our best estimates of what's really going on.
Right.
And this is what we just think, you know?
This is why the human forecaster is there to look beyond.
They're not perfect and they're never going to be perfect for lots of reasons. But, you know, we're just trying to make them better.
Yeah.
And, you know, the more you understand of what is happening, mm-hmm. the better you can simulate it.
Yeah. Speaking of just making the models better, we did see that first and foremost with Otis when the hurricane hunters flew in and got specific ground truth data that it was a Cat 3 mm-hmm. at a time when just observing it from space from a satellite perspective might have thought a little bit less. Mm-hmm. So that data goes into the hurricane forecast models and is able to help give at least a little more. There was a better projection of what was going to happen.
The better you understand what you have at hand in front of you, the more likely you're going to have a better forecast. Mm-hmm. It's not always the case, but that's certainly one of the things that you want. You want the most accurate initial conditions. Mm-hmm.
The problem was that was a few hours before landfall.
Yeah.
It was all the timing and proximity to land, again, which makes this a nightmare scenario, that it was rapidly intensifying close to landfall of a populated place.
Yeah. And, you know, it's going to happen. As I said earlier, there are going to be other places mm-hmm. That are also highly populated along the shores of the Gulf mm-hmm. or the shores of the nearby Atlantic that are going to see something like this. It's only a matter of time, you know? So we need to maybe figure out how to prepare quickly and mm-hmm. react quickly, because we are now in an era of things happening quickly, like RI. Mm-hmm. So we need to maybe, I don't know, PQ, prepare quickly for an RI event.
I think you're right. I think you're right, Greg Quista. I think that's actually a good place to wrap it up. It's well said that we are in a changing environment. We're seeing every year. And you need to be ready for maybe what we haven't seen before.
The fingerprints of climate change are all over this, you know, and they're all over events like this. And it just is a reminder that, you know, you can't, it's almost impossible to attribute one particular event to that, but it's all happening in the environment mm-hmm. that is giving it more opportunity and a greater likelihood of happening. And this is the new future, you know?
Yeah. Greg Postel, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Jen. Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
This was a good Weather Geeks podcast.
Hopefully we'll do more maybe on winter stuff and who knows.
There'll be plenty. Hopefully no more hurricanes of the season, though we know it's not even November yet. And we know
it's not November.
The Atlantic season runs through the end of November.
It does. And you know what? You can get a hurricane any time of year.
You can.
Hurricane season ends technically at the end of November, but as you know, I mean, that's just because statistically that's where we've seen it really drop off, but it doesn't mean it can't happen after that.
Exactly.
All right. Scary thoughts for Halloween, huh?
We will be watching. Thank you all for listening to this Weather Geeks podcast.